Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And we're very blessed to have Douglas Riggs with us. And Douglas has a special guest, Doug Woodward. He is an author and many other interesting things. So, Douglas, take it away.
Well, thank you, Georgianne, again for this opportunity. And it's great, Doug, having you on.
Thank you.
Yes, I met Doug Woodward at the Future Congress Prophecy Conference that was held in Branson this last July. And I was very interested in the subject that that you addressed, Doug, at the time in your workshop, which was Ubermensch and the Antichrist. Also, that you have written three other books. And, you know, if you'd like to just talk a little bit about how you got into where you are now in terms of being an author, and then we'll just
talk
about the conference and just allow the Lord to direct us. Okay.
Great. No, I agree. Well, it's great to talk with you again, Douglas. It seems like you and I always enjoy the conversations, and hopefully we'll not only invite Georgianne into the conversations, but the rest of the listeners as well, because we do talk about some interesting subjects, no doubt. Maybe just give everyone a minute or so on my background. I am from Oklahoma originally. I'm 57 years old. I've spent most of my career in information technology. I've worked as an executive for Oracle, for Microsoft. I've been a partner at Ernst & Young. So I've been sort of a computer management person for most of my career. However, during that time, I've served in a number of capacities within the church as elder or member of a consistory, depending upon the nature of the church. I also started off, before getting into information technology, as a youth minister and minister associate, both in the Methodist Church as well as in the Reformed Church of America. So I've had some ministerial background, not a lot, but a little bit, and but have been involved in churches for a long time, ever since I was a child. And throughout this period of time, I have been a student of Bible prophecy as well as the Word. I might just delve into it for a moment. My personal testimony has to do with when I was 15 years old, I was diagnosed with a very nasty form of cancer known as rhabdomyosarcoma. At that time, this was in 1969, the the rate at which folks could survive that, the survivability rate, was well below 10%. So consequently, both from just the sort of the facts of that situation of surviving that cancer, as well as the tremendous support I got from family members, from my church, from a slew of pastors that I got to know that visited me in the hospital and so forth, I really was drawn very close to the Lord during that time, as you can imagine. At 15, you know, there's perhaps not as much awareness of the matters of life and death as you develop as you get older. But certainly at that time, I was, you know, very conscious of the fact that my life was sort of hanging by a tether, I suppose you could say, and so it drew me very much into the Word. I grew a tremendous amount, and consequently, as a result of that, I've always felt that there's an aspect of my life that's to be sort of especially dedicated to the Lord and to His ministry. And so anyway, consequently, now jumping way up now to almost present day, a few years ago, I think coupled between both an awareness of how much was going on in the world regarding the 2012 phenomenon, the story of the Mayan calendar and some of the prophetic topics that were being popularized, and recognizing, of course, from the very inception that these topics were being handled by unbelievers and folks that did not understand, did not have a spiritual or a biblical basis for their research and their work. I began to probe and look at what were folks saying about the whole issue of 2012. So it was one of the kind of the key issues that got me very focused once again on on prophecy and deciding that perhaps I should do some writing. So that's kind of, I'll pause right there and just sort of say that's sort of how I got kind of into the writing phenomenon about 3 years ago was sensing that throughout my studies of over the many decades, I, of course, had always felt that we were drawing closer and closer to the return of the Lord. But I felt that something special was happening right now that was sort of the culmination of a number of things in the occult, as well as in the signs that I was reading and feeling that the Lord was soon to return. So that sort of piqued my interest, you might say, and also got me very focused on what is it I could be doing to contribute to awakening my friends, my family, and then reaching out beyond that to others through doing something that I always wanted to do but had never really made the time for, which was to write. And so that's kind of how I got started.
Well, I appreciate that introduction, Doug. Before we got on the air tonight, I did look up on WorldNet Daily, read Jim Fletcher's review of your book, Decoding Doomsday, and he spoke very highly of the book. I have not read that. I wasn't even aware of it until recently, but he spoke very highly, and the very fact that you got that recommendation on WorldNet Daily,
very much. It was very much appreciated, and in fact, I told Jim that when I finally met him as a result of the review, that I'd have to buy him a cup of coffee when we got together at the conference in Missouri. Actually, I don't think I made good on that promise, but Jim promised me I'd have another opportunity to buy him a cup of coffee sometime soon. But yes, I was fortunate to have a very good review, and whatever it means at the moment, I've noticed that Amazon has sold out of the book, so apparently it's doing pretty well. I just typed in a second ago, Decoding Doomsday, and saw that there are many, many bookstores, Christian bookstores, that are offering the book right now. And although Amazon apparently is sold out at the moment. So it looks like it's doing well.
And it's also been great to hear you on the Prophecy in the News. Of course, J.R. Church went to be the Lord recently, but Gary Sherman has been doing an excellent job. And he's interviewed you. He interviewed you on this book and, of course, some of the contemporary issues that were at Branson. So I think that's really excellent that this is getting out there to a good listening audience and a good viewing audience, and I really appreciate the folks at Prophecy in the News that they have given you that venue to speak as well.
It's certainly been a great way for me to begin to, I guess, sort of share with people some of my ideas and insights, and I have a particular writing style. I mix a little humor into what I'm talking about, even when the subjects get kind of dark, and that seems to be well appreciated by the readers that have come up and talked to me about the book. But I've had an opportunity to be on the show with Gary, I think something like five times. One of those was also with Tom Horn, when he and I talked together with Gary about the subject of 2012. Most recently, Gary and I have done a show, which I think is going to be coming up and shared both on the websites as well as on their TV network across the country, on the issue of transhumanism and talking about the book Pandemonium's Engine, which we'll probably talk some more about tonight, which I was fortunate enough to be invited to prepare a chapter for, which was entitled The Übermensch and the Antichrist, which is also what I gave one of my talks at the conference in Missouri last month, was on that same subject. We can talk about that as well tonight.
That particular interview, I've already watched it. It's posted on Vimeo, and I've sent that out to everyone on my email list. I'm assuming it's the same one.
I was going to say that you're seeing the 10-minute one. We actually did a 30-minute one that hasn't been shown yet, so I think it'll be out very soon.
Okay, that you're right. That is the shorter version, so I look forward to that. Since you brought that up, the book, The Pandemonium's Engine, I picked up a copy while I was at Branson, and as I've been reading through it, of course, I read through your contribution. The Uber mentioned the Antichrist, and of course that was your topic, at least one of your topics at Branson. Made it a real priority to sit in on that because of the kind of work that I do and the whole Nazi connection with the current trauma-based mind control and the people's connection with Josef Mengele. But I really appreciated just the way you went through the PowerPoint and you presented, you know, the Übermensch and the Antichrist and that whole connection. As you, you know, when you spoke at the conference, I mean, you had a whole plethora of various options you could have spoken on. Why did you pick that one? And I'm certainly glad you did, but I would like to hear from you. Why did you pick that particular subject?
Well, there's probably, you know, sort of a kind of an obvious reason, then there's probably a less obvious reason. The obvious reason was because I had written a chapter in the book Pandemonium's Engine on that subject, and I thought it would be logical because I knew that a few of the people, we had about 700 people at that conference, but I knew that some would already have had a chance to read the book, and they might want to have me amplify some of the material in there, which I did in the presentation, and so that was sort of the obvious reason. I guess the less obvious reason is probably related to kind of why I think you appreciated the subject, which is understanding the historical and philosophical background to the, I guess, the support for the notion of the Antichrist that was really coming about in Germany and in Europe late in the 19th century, and then obviously came forward with Hitler and Nazism in an enormous way then early in the 20th century. And so I felt that, plus as I began to study the notions of the Übermensch, which Uber, of course, is the sort of the German word for super or hyper, and Mensch is the word for man, sort of Superman or Hyperman, you might call it, sometimes translated Overman. But as I got into that and studied it, it was, I thought, a very, certainly more of a philosophical, but nevertheless a very direct expansion on the notion of the Antichrist. And so I knew that many of the people in the conference, of course, were there with a kind of a prophetic interest, and I thought it would be probably a topic that they were not familiar with. And so I thought it might be intriguing for them to realize how much sort of philosophical content had been put together by Friedrich Nietzsche, who was the sort of the guy who coined the term the Übermensch and its ideas. And so I thought it might be something that people would find to be pretty fascinating, and I guess you could speak to whether or not you saw that correlation and whether you felt it was a bit intriguing to delve into that a bit.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, as I look at the history of Nazi Germany, of course, what shaped the ideology, and it's a cult foundation, you know, going back to a number of individuals and people like Helena Petrovna Blavatsky and Eckert, mm-hmm. and there's a number of people that you have mm-hmm. noted in your work. But to see that in the science and the ideology, it was all based on an occult mysticism, and
right.
And there was a spirituality to it, although the spirituality would be humanism. And I think, you know, the whole, you know, one of the questions is, you know, why was eugenics so important to the goal of the Third mm-hmm. Reich and attaining that mm-hmm. Third Reich in terms of seeking to attain this goal of Superman? I mean, this was right at the heart and focus of their whole Aryan supremacy mentality of who they were as Germans.
Absolutely. It's the case that most people would assume that Hitler's goal was to conquer the world. But that was only part of his goal. It was sort of only a means to an end. His real super sort of plan was to see a mutation in humanity that specifically in Germany and in Aryan blood and in the sort of Teutonic races that they would be, in fact, sort of re-engineered or mutated into an Übermensch, an Überman, and that they would then lead Germany to, and the rest of the world, into a complete remaking of humankind. And so the goal of making humanity, let's say, you know, the same goal as transhumanism, which is to improve upon our humanity, that was very much the goals that Hitler was really driving towards. And so it was much more than just conquering the world and you know, demonstrating German superiority. It was about reengineering the human race. And I don't even know that Hitler fully grasped the implications of what he was attempting to do. Certainly the discussion of the Übermensch and the generic, the sort of the eugenics that he got into, trying to craft the Superman and so forth. But I don't fully know if he understood the implications, and certainly, Douglas, in what you have shared with this audience before, the implications are far more sinister than simply, let's say, growing a human ear on the back of a mouse. There's a lot more to it than that.
Well, my understanding is of this whole regime is as they got into the occult or the black arts, of course, they saw themselves as superior. But as they're drawing on these powers for information and direction and guidance in their science, their technology, and of course the whole eugenics program, the deception that so transformed their thinking was certain people, they would justify and genocide and killing them to purify the German blood and then to move towards a God-man status, where our current species would be replaced with a God-man status. And, of course, that is the whole modern-day beginning, if we could put it that way, of what we see in the days of Noah. In other words, I see what we are today in history. It seems like the staging area for history was preeminently in Nazi Germany.
It seems to be the case that it was. And there are so many aspects of this, but the genetics issue and the realization of a new man, of an Übermensch, as I said, was really what Hitler was after. But in that process, of course, you know, which we also see in the philosophy of Nietzsche, there were all kinds of other things that were going on that were sort of clearing the way for this. One of those was, I guess, sort of the necessity for the Übermensch was based upon Nietzsche's idea that God was dead. And by that, he didn't mean that God had sort of died a literal death, but he meant that God had been proven to be completely irrelevant to Europe at the end of the 19th century. And so this notion of, if that is true, if God is dead, if God is not relevant, if there, you know, what is then the basis for ethics and morals? What is the basis for hope for the future? And so what Nietzsche was calling for was this Übermensch who would basically facilitate what he called the transvaluation of values, a rethinking of what values are important. And so he essentially had great contempt for Christianity because he felt that Christianity was contemptible of man and hated mankind as mankind was. By that he really was suggesting that man was held captive by Christianity to guilt, that mankind was basically shackled and could not be able to achieve what humankind should be able to achieve. And so Nietzsche had a tremendous hatred for the church and as God as well. And so so much of what he was teaching and promoting was very much a result of his hatred for the church, and then his supposition that he was wise enough to propose a means to overcome the death of God, and that this new Superman could live without God and could compose his own sort of world, his own ethics, his own values, and could live life to the fullest and wouldn't be hindered any longer by a Christian gospel that he believed was very much, as I said, contemptible to human beings and to their aspirations, which we might say those aspirations are mostly aspirations to achieve sin and to realize sin, as opposed to perhaps more moral and appropriate ambitions.
Yeah, I was just going to read the introduction to your chapter here in Pandemonium's Engine. You contrast the two ideologies. At the beginning of your chapter, you quote from Nietzsche, and quoting, "What is good? All that enhances the feeling of power, the will to power, and power itself in man. What is bad? All that proceeds from weakness. The weak and the botched shall perish, for first principle of our humanity, and they ought even to be helped to perish. What is more harmful than any vice? Practical sympathy with all the botched and the weak Christianity. The problem I see in this work is, what type of man must be reared, must be willed, as having the highest value, as being the most worthy of life, and the surest guarantee of the future. And in these, a higher type certainly manifests itself. I should say, and in these, a higher type mm-hmm. certainly manifests itself. Something mm-hmm. which represents a kind of Superman. And then, of course, mm-hmm. in contrast to that, you quote the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of God. And, of course, Nietzsche just utterly despised. He said, the fact that Jesus mm-hmm. Christ would die on the cross with someone else, he said, mm-hmm. that's just the opposite of his value system.
Absolutely. One of the reasons that he despised Christ is he said, you know, that Christ was the Antichrist because he should have fought for his life, but he gave it up. And in effect, what he said, therefore, is that what that says is that Christianity doesn't affirm life. What is it, the Jewish toast, the halachia, the life, that Christianity doesn't affirm life, and that Christ, should never have allowed himself to be crucified. It sure sounds like the devil talking, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely an Antichrist mentality. But in terms of the Reich, and of course, Himmler was one of the leaders in the whole the SS, and he was perhaps in some ways just as evil, if not more so in some respects, than Hitler. But how would you say people like Nietzsche and, of course, Blavatsky and some of these people that were mystics and, you know, they were definitely demonized. I mean, they were channelers. They had mm-hmm. definitely connections to the powers of darkness. Could you talk about how they shaped the whole ideology of the top leaders in the Reich, including, of course, Hitler and all of those people
yes.
directly under him?
Yes, I could. I can. There were two societies that were particularly important in kind of creating the foundation for Nazism, which also started off as sort of the German Workers' Party, it was opposed to the Bolsheviks, who these Germans decried as being, those Jewish Bolsheviks. So the fascists hated the Bolsheviks, and of course that led to a conflict and sort of street fights and riots between them. Hitler was locked up in a prison with a man named Dietrich Eckart in the 1920-1921 time frame, and it was Eckart who had a significant influence upon Hitler and began to teach Hitler more about the black arts. In Hitler's teenage years, Hitler had discovered mescaline. Mescaline was had just been sort of newly, you might say, conjured, but using that metaphorically by medicine. And mescaline was beginning to be used as a way to kind of as it is and has been since then to stimulate one's consciousness or higher consciousness. But Hitler was very influenced by taking drugs, and so he was already into sort of consciousness raising. Hitler was influenced, though, by Eckart. Eckart actually taught Hitler the magic, sexual magic, the black magic Mathers and Aleister Crowley from the Golden Dawn. And I'm working on a new book now. I'm going into more detail on this, but there was a remarkable influence of Englishmen on the Germans at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. One of the societies, there's two societies I started to talk about. One is the Vril, V-R-I-L, the Vril. The other was the Thule Society, T-H-U-L-E. I want to pronounce it Thule, but I believe most people pronounce it Thule, is the proper German pronunciation. The Vril actually came from a fiction novel. It was a novel written by a guy named Edward Bulwark Lytton. And Lytton actually wrote The Last Days of Pompeii, which is his most famous book, but he wrote a book called The Coming Race. And it was a fictional account of a race of supermen that lived under the earth, lived in a hollow earth. A hollow earth is another theory that the Germans put forth. And Lytton's concept, though, were that there were these supermen, descendants from Atlantis, that lived under the earth, and they were people that had learned to use the power of the Vril. And the Vril is very much like the Force in Star Wars. And so this notion of the Vril actually caught on in Germany about 25, 30 years later. There were a number of mediums that got together, women mediums, that considered themselves Valkyries. In fact, Valkyries, you've heard of the Ride of the Valkyries and Wagner's The Ride of the Valkyries. Well, the Valkyries were female warriors that were giants, and their duty when their Norse men would be slain on the battlefield would be to tend to them, and if they had died, it would then be their job to resurrect them and take them to Valhalla. And in Valhalla, they were to serve them food and drink. So a little bit like the concept of the 72 virgins, I think, in Islam. But that's what the Valkyries were that we've heard about. And so originally the Vril were just a group of women mediums that got together, and then it broadened. The Vril were fairly quickly subsumed into the Thule Society. And it was in the Thule Society that was actually formed in 1919 that it was decided that a person like a Hitler would be needed to steer the course and sort of be the mouthpiece for this occult plan to, in effect, take over German politics and lead the German nation out of the defeat and the misery that they were in at that time after World War One. And so Eckhart was very involved. In fact, Hitler in Mein Kampf even refers to Eckhart as the actual father of Nazism. And so you had in Thule actually a society that was built upon some ancient Norse legends, the concept of a land called Hyperborea. Hyperborea was to be a great land to the north. The land of Hyperborea was actually mentioned by the Greeks in their ancient literature, and probably it referred to the country of England. There's some early Greek historians writing 400 B.C. that one can gather that it may have well been England that they had discovered. But nevertheless, the notion was that by the time it had been transformed in Germany in the early in the 20th century, that Hyperborea was the land from which these great supermen would come forth, and was the home more or less of the Aryan race, and it was the Hyperboreans that really gave Hitler, I think, a great deal of aspiration to turn the German blood back into sort of the blood of the Hyperboreans. And it's interesting, a lot of people like to talk about Nietzsche as misunderstood and misquoted, and that Hitler appropriated Nietzsche incorrectly, and that Nietzsche, you know, would not have supported what Hitler was doing. But, you know, even Nietzsche referred to his followers as fellow Hyperboreans. So this notion that the Germans were, you know, the very occult-oriented, very caught up in the occult, it goes even all the way back to Goethe and Faust and his interpretation of sort of the mindset of the Germans. Very different than the English And yet, as it turns out, as I'll show, hopefully in the book that I'll get out in a few months, that the English were, it turns out, great promoters of the occult and had an enormous influence upon the Germans, not only in terms of occult, but even eugenics and other things. So it turns out that the notion of the Antichrist, while it was really brought forth and championed and had a harmful, horrible impact upon the world, it's not exclusively a German phenomenon. And that's a point that really does need to be made, that the English, Americans, as you well know, Douglas, there are no people that we can settle on and say they are the enemy, that they are the responsible for bringing the Antichrist forth. It is a notion and a concept that is as old as humankind and as old as our history. It just happens to have reached probably its worst example with Nazi Germany in the 1920s and then on into the 30s and World War II. Let's take a breath.
Yeah, and as you're talking, and I don't know just where the confluence would be, but of course there is the ideology of the Russian mystic Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, and also he sent different, I think, what archaeologists or researchers over into Tibet, and they were seeking to enhance their goal through some type of a spiritual connection there. So at some point, if you could integrate all that into that, would shape the ideology of the Third Reich.
Sure. The notion of theosophy, or the ideology of theosophy, was originally developed, you might say, in America by Madame Blavatsky, whose real name was Alina Hahn, but she took on the much more I suppose, sophisticated, cultic-sounding name, Madame Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. And her accomplice was an interesting character named Henry Alcott. And Alcott turns out to also have been very influential in basically giving Eastern mysticism something of a rebirth. Eastern mysticism had somewhat fallen out of favor and was not really regarded that highly. Certainly in the West, until theosophy came along and basically combined Eastern mysticism, Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, with, you might say, a strong dose of American individualism and science, trying to use an Eastern mysticism a platform to explain why the paranormal works, why is it that mediums work, and so forth. So really what Alcott and Blavatsky were trying to do was to create a synthetic or syncretic, I guess you could say syncretic, religion that was a synthesis of all of these things. Well, this, of course, influenced all of these folks. Rudolf Glauer, who was actually later the head of the Thule Society, had studied Blavatsky when he lived in Turkey in the 19-teens when he was there as a young man. Every one of these individuals were influenced by theosophy. And every one of the theosophers essentially wrote through a channeler. They were channelers. And so they basically had spirit beings that came to them, and they used automatic writing to write out what it is those spirit beings told them to do. Blavatsky did this. Her father had quite an occult collection of books. He also supposedly channeled, or had a spirit through which he channeled. Her successor, Alice Bailey, who was kind of the main person forming the New Age movement, again in America in the 1930s, 1940s, until she died in 1947. Alice Bailey also channeled her books through, I think, the Zhuwal Khan. I have to remember if that's their correct name. There are many names that these individuals had in terms of channelers. But there's also a gentleman named Benjamin Krim, who was a successor to Alice Bailey. He, too, channels his writings. And so there's a whole thread that we could go down just in terms of this whole channeling issue. And I do talk a bit about that in a book that's going to be coming out this fall on which I write about, on the CIA and remote viewing and clairvoyance and channeling and so forth. But anyway, back to your question, though, which is the fact that Hitler, kind of like we learned in the Indiana Jones, the search for the, you know, the lost Ark of the Covenant, Hitler was trying to find these different relics from the past and was trying to see if he could latch on to their occult powers and use them in some way. But his he sent off a some famous mountain climbers. The story 7 Years in Tibet touches on a bit on this the story, although not fully accurate. But nevertheless, there was a famous climber and a whole team that went to Tibet, and they were seeking to find out where the Aryan race, which was believed to be an Indo-European or Indian and European race, where that race had originated. And it was so outlandish that Himmler believed that these descendants actually came from heaven. They were descendants from the Battle of Fire and Ice that occurred in heaven, and that there would be able they would be able to discover a traces of a white race in Tibet to prove this theory that the Aryans had had arisen through these means. And so anyway, there was so there was a considerable amount of interest in this. And a group that worked in Tibet on behalf of Germany in the late 1930s, mid and late 1930s, for a number of years, doing this kind of exploration and doing skull measurements and trying to trace the roots of the Aryan race in Tibet. Needless to say, they probably didn't enjoy much success in finding those roots. If anything, they probably proved that in the trade routes that Marco Polo had helped establish, that there probably were some cases of intermarriage of European folks with folks that lived in Asia, but no real traces of the Aryan race, I'm afraid.
The question, I think, was important to me, and I'll just give a little side note here. In
work
with survivors, they've been taken all over the world in very high-level rituals with various heads of state as well as world religions, working with one of our girls here who is really fully integrated now. But when she was a little girl, very young, she was taken all over Tibet for 6 months with these Tibetan monks and was, and I have to be very graphic about this because otherwise it won't have any meaning, and sodomized by these monks as a ritual. To channel spirits in her, and it was over 1,000 of them. So we had to deal with those powers that had infested her through these horrific traumas. But this ideology and this spiritual framework of these Tibetan monks is very, very powerful. And my understanding is that some of the occult power that was somehow incorporated into Nazi Germany, there was some interface with these Tibetan monks or masters. Do you have any knowledge of that? It's been a while since I've read on this. But
Yes, there supposedly were a number of monks that were brought from Tibet to Berlin, and supposedly traces of their skulls and remains were found as the war was concluding. There were very specific stories told about, these monks being brought to Berlin, that they were influencing Hitler and were looked to, I guess, as another source of information. It's discussed in Trevor Ravenscroft's book, The Spirit of Destiny, and so I have read about that. I can confirm that it is a fact that occurred. There was also there. I can also indicate a little bit. I remember about it was that there were sort of two different clans. One clan that was related to Shambhala in Tibet, which was supposedly you may recall the myths of Shambhala and Three Dog Night sung about that everybody was happy and everybody was kind on the road to Shambhala, but not so.
Yeah.
The road to Shambhala was not such a happy road.
Yeah.
But there was one clan that was associated sort of with evil and another clan that was associated with good, supposedly. And both of these lived sort of in the underworld in the mountains of Tibet. And this is part of the folklore, but the actual evidence that there were Tibetan monks that were brought to Berlin and participated in some way with the Third Reich. That appears to be very true.
Yeah, and I had heard from one source that some of them were they were sacrificed to release power. The monks were actually sacrificed. I can't
mm-hmm.
remember the source on that, but
mm-hmm.
I think what our listeners need to recognize is that when it comes to the spread of the gospel, the contact Paul Hadaway, he's an author, and I've discussed this with him on one of our visits. He lives in New Zealand. He's a prolific writer. He is probably the most prominent authority on China and the house church movement in China,
mm-hmm.
alive today. But I asked him about the Tibetan monks, because they're in the southern region in terms of a religious force and a power. He said,
mm-hmm.
To the Chinese people, Islam is, yes, that's a challenge. But to missionaries, the Tibetan monks, the Tibetan Buddhism, is very, very powerful. For example, he told me of this particular incident of a missionary that was going into their territory to, of course, it's a challenge to the spiritual powers that are
mm-hmm.
That dominate the Tibetan Buddhism. And
mm-hmm.
The missionary said it's the worst that they know of in the world. I mean,
yeah.
the spiritual force is so great. And to give you an example, he said this one missionary was of course, taken by these monks, and he was they killed an animal. They sewed him inside the animal with the outside moisture of the skin on the outside. They sewed him up in it and then set him on the rock and all day, and so it gradually dried and contracted and suffocated him. Just a long, slow death. I mean, these
mm-hmm.
people are very brutal. So
this
is their belief system. There was another missionary I was in touch with that they were over there in Tibet, and they went into one of these coffee places where these monks were, and they were all watching pornography. All of them.
Wow. Yeah.
So,
wow.
You know, it's very dark, and so if he commandeers that particular ideology, and that's incorporated into Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, the whole foundation of what we call the New Age
right.
movement,
right.
all the other mysticism and their contact with the powers of darkness, we have perhaps, I don't know, maybe you could just make a quick comment on this, because I really want
mm-hmm.
to go in and make the connection between where we are today in history and
yeah.
the Reich. But
yeah.
in terms of an entire regime being not based on, you know, like we have the Constitution, we have the Bill of Rights.
Right.
It was an
right.
occult theocracy. That's what it was.
Yeah.
It wasn't even, I mean, I don't know how else to describe it, that the Third Reich was an occult theocracy, which is like a blueprint for the kingdom of Antichrist. Do you know of any other nation in modern history that was, was an occult theocracy?
No, I think you're exactly right. I think that's really what is very clear to those of us that have studied this, that is so unclear and so unknown to you know, sort of the rest of the population, is just how evil and diabolical Hitler and the Third Reich was, what their real goals were, what their means were to achieve their ends, how involved the you know, the occult was and every facet of what they were doing. There's a book that I refer to frequently. It was done by two Frenchmen, Louis Pauwels and Jacques Sébergier, called The Morning of the Magicians. Used to be called The Dawn of Magic, but it's called The Morning of the Magicians: Secret Societies, Conspiracies, and Vanished Civilizations. But they talk precisely about this, that Hitler's notions were completely opposite of the rest of the world. They were based upon this occult view of the world, and such an outlandish things that Hitler thought of himself, and believed that he could change the weather. He believed that he had all kinds of magical powers, and apparently at times he did. He predicted supposedly the exact date of FDR's death. There are a number of things that supposedly he was clairvoyant about, and certainly the fact that it was so difficult for the assassins to ever assassinate him makes one feel like perhaps he had some kind of a clairvoyant power or some kind of a spirit about him that was able to keep him from being harmed. In fact, the soldiers that served with him in World War I, they commented specifically when they were in the trenches together, basically, you know, enduring this horrible trench warfare during World War One, that Hitler was just kind of laissez-faire, just kind of, you know, que sera, sera, that he felt protected. He felt that he had a mission in life, and that he knew he was not going to be harmed, and so he would take risk and put other people at risk, and his fellow comrades basically grew to hate him because of his sort of nonchalant attitude towards towards death. So you know, so there's no question that Hitler was very, very unique in that perception, and that the Third Reich was so radically different from any other political regime. And we can talk about Rome, and we could talk about Caesar, and we could talk about the anti-Christian elements of that, but nothing compared to the Third Reich. And nothing
know,
real. Well, I'm sorry, go ahead, Joyce. Right? Go ahead.
To illustrate this, the Nuremberg trials were literally a fiasco. They didn't address any of the real issues.
You're exactly right. It's discussed both by Paul Wells and Bergier, as well as by Ravenscroft, that they specifically decided not to bring up the level of the, you know, how entrenched Hitler and Himmler and Rauschen and all of the different Germans were into the occult, because they were fearful that it would give them an insanity defense.
Yeah.
And so Churchill was very specific about not wanting to let the world know that it had happened, that the human race had sunk so low that a regime of supposedly intelligent you know, human beings based upon Western sort of Cartesian thinking had allowed itself to come to the place where it believed in Satan, and then it was actively you know, wanting Satan in effect to take control of the regime, the politics, and their country. It just was just too much for people to believe, and so they basically, as you're saying, Georgianne, just decided that they could not bring this up.
Oh boy.
Well, you know, one of the goals that I've had to, and just the work that I do, is study military history, study leaders, and it's given me kind of a backbone to deal with what I'm dealing with, because it keeps you in reality when you study history. But I watched this documentary sometime back, and I don't remember what it was, but it was on the occult theocracy of Germany. And this is really, really striking, and it's a very key point in the history of the Reich, is that when they, you know, the strategically, they should have, if they were going to win the war, they shouldn't have started an Eastern Front with Russia. They should have pushed all the way through, taken England, and I'm not for that, but I mean from a military standpoint, they should have secured that. But they opened up this front because they had this, of course, this ideological feud with the Bolsheviks, and they're inferior, and so it's part of their Aryan ascendancy to wipe out the Bolsheviks. So they make this strategic blunder, you know, and they start this Eastern Front with Russia. Well, you know, they're the superior race, and so when, you know, in the beginning with all their blitzkrieg warfare, I mean, what is it, just a million casualties? It was horrific. But the Russians, the thing was turned around, and of course they were pushed back. And at that particular point, and this is a key hinge point, this is where they really began ramping up killing the Jews. As many as they could. Why? Because the rationale was, if our German blood had been more pure, if we had been more effective in cleansing our German identity, we wouldn't have lost. So the rationale was, we've got to exterminate that which is contaminating the body of the German people of the Jews, and that was the main in this documentary. This is how that was presented. I thought that is shocking in terms of the deception and how the enemy got a hold of this particular mindset of these people to wipe out the Jewish people.
Right. No, it does go beyond what, you know, you can kind of sympathize a bit with Churchill trying to, you know, to figure out the appropriate tack to take in the Nuremberg trials, because no one would believe, you know, just how incredible the evilness was that was incarnated in these individuals. And it truly is astounding. And so I totally agree.
Well, so, I'd like to just begin to transition a little bit here, and maybe not a full transition quite yet,
sure,
but a transition ultimately to, are there any parallels with where we are in this nation and what we see in pre-World War II Germany? And I would like to make some connections, because in the context of seeing what happened in Germany and where we are as a nation today, you know, I read those two chapters that are part of your new book, which I appreciate you sending to me. And what you do, you establish that in our so-called secular society, the military and some of our sciences and all that is, of course, encompassing the transgenic and the enhanced human technologies that's going on today, that is really was a major focus of the conference at Branson. But in this particular scenario that where we are in history, you know, in America, we have a history, as you well documented in those chapters, of all these different projects, whether it's in the military, whether it's the CIA, where they may not see it as a cult power. They just may see it as, we got to do this because the Russians are doing it, whether it's remote viewing or the MK Ultra. But it seems to me that we as a nation are right in the same kind of framework in terms of spirituality, spiritual forces, that pre-Nazi Germany was leading up to World War II.
Well, I think that's there's a lot of truth in what you're saying there, and I believe that is the case. I think that it all stems back from, and you have had obviously hand-to-hand combat in the trenches in this respect, that apparently at the end of World War II, and this is pretty well documented, this is sort of part of the Operation Paperclip scenario, that many German scientists and selected German intelligence personnel they made a bargain with America to come to America rather than going to the Soviet Union. And America gave them many privileges in terms of exerting leadership that resulted essentially in NASA being run for the most part by German rocket scientists, Nazi rocket scientists. Von Braun himself was a member of the SS. And so there's that aspect of it in terms of the rocket science and what we learned and what we were able to accomplish. But there's also a supposedly a group that was in charge of intelligence for the Germans on the Soviet front, and they were brought into the CIA and were responsible for basically Soviet intelligence, but they were given a very long leash. Basically, they were allowed to report sort of barely to American handlers. They essentially ran their own show, and eventually it was agreed that once Germany had a sovereign nation again, that they would transition back to, in effect, what became West Germany. And so there was an enormous amount of corrupting of American governmental agencies, not everywhere, but in selected areas, where Nazis were brought in as a means for America to gain access to the knowledge that they had developed in rocket science, in weaponry, and a whole bunch of other things. In fact, I've been working on a chapter in terms of the types of physics that the Germans were developing that was very different from the physics of Einstein and Heisenberg, and really accommodated the possibility of faster than speed light, of possibly traveling in space at hyper speeds, the flying saucer concepts. There's more practical things, just basically submarines that had the ability to run stealthy to run at very high speeds, at very low depths for a very long period of time. So, in fact, there's an article that was in Time magazine, I think in 1947, that basically said that America was fortunate that it won the war about a week, you know, just in the nick of time, that another week in Germany may have brought out some of these super weapons that they were so close to developing. And I guess it's the person I've been reading recently, Joseph Farah, talking a bit about the Third Reich and these new physics and so forth. He makes the point that, you know, America apparently did some kind of a Faustian sort of bargain with these Nazis, who had not only foreseen that they could reposition themselves in America or in the Soviet Union, those that were unfortunate enough to get captured by the Soviets, but that they would be able to carry on their plans and their plots to continue to try to build the master race, to influence society towards an occult type of environment. And, you know, Doug, you could probably talk with more, you know, data points than I, but this has been well documented. And and so as I talk a bit about in these two chapters you referred to, is just the issue of the CIA and then later other military intelligence services basically learning and using with sort of without any regard for the meaning of it, clairvoyance, the ability to do remote viewing, to use it as a weapon of war. And, of course, that it really raises some really intriguing questions, you know, is what's the difference between an occult religion and a Christian religion besides the ideology? If they're both religions, why is it that one is banned and why is one allowed as an impact in terms of how the government is and government programs and government operations are allowed? And so, you know, perhaps the CIA doesn't think of clairvoyance as an occult religion, but there's a strong amount of history that disagrees with that conclusion. Yeah. So,
well, they're pragmatists. In other words, if it works, and if the Soviets are using it and it's working, we don't need to be bothered with the spirituality. We just need to commandeer this as a resource and weaponize it, because it's if we don't, then we'll fall behind. It's a very pragmatic, I think. But I,
absolutely,
you know, I would just say that you know, our interviews with Josef Mengele, or excuse me, remembering Josef Mengele, not with him, but remembering him.
Right.
I've worked with people here and throughout the United States, numerous people who have been programmed by Josef Mengele, hired by members of the royal family. He was protected by elements of the CIA while he was here, and of course they will all deny it. But, you know, I did an interview with Dr. Stan Montita recently, and he said he remembers asking Dr. Colin Ross if any of his clients had reported being programmed by Dr. Mengele in association with CIA. And he said, yes, he could recall at least three. Well, I've got more than that.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you just incorporate this angel of death and the fact that he would be somewhere collaborating at some level of the CIA to create, you know, undetectable agents for espionage, that just shows you where we are as a nation in terms of ethics. I mean, as I see where we are, and I'm going to quote something from the Pandemonium's engine here before we're through, but where we are as a nation, I mean, we have to stand back. We can look at the history. But if we just stand back and read the prophets, and I just finished reading the Minor Prophets again, and we have what is addressed. First of all, if the people understood that all the prophets are writing primarily, except Habakkuk is unique, but they're writing first and foremost to the covenant people of God. So it would be like this. If you pick up the prophets, and you read the message of Jeremiah to the recipients, or Ezekiel, or Isaiah. In our context, he's talking to the church. Okay? Now, he's not talking to the church, but by way of analogy. So if we somehow take these messages of warning that we see in the prophets to the church today, first, we have the spiritual component, that is, the priests were in apostasy, the prophets were prophesying dreams, that were of their own heart, and of course they were in conflict with Jeremiah. We see that in Jeremiah 23. We see in Amos that the prophet who speaks in the gate is considered mad. They told him, go away, you dreamer, and prophesy somewhere else. So we have the whole spiritual component because of the priests that were opposing him and the prophets. But then you have the kings, which is the political. He would give specific messages, Jeremiah to the kings, and so when we bring that over into our nation today, because we have a Christian foundation for much of who we are as a people, we're the only Gentile nation in history that has had any comparable spiritual privilege and a blessing next to Israel. We're the only nation, Gentile nation. And Jesus said, the light that is in you, if that becomes darkness, how great is the darkness? So as a nation, as we are turning away from that which represents our founding fathers, and I know there's that whole element that came in at Jamestown that's illuminist, but we still have that element that came in at Plymouth that was Christian. And so it's been going side by side. Where we are today versus that which represents the founding structure of our founding fathers is so far removed, it's not recoverable. I mean, this is where people don't get it. I mean, America can't be saved. I hope people are listening to this. If people, it's the church in the West. I mean, we need to pray. If we're going to pray, we need to pray for the church because the church is basically asleep, and the prophets are crying out to the church as to their spiritual condition if we make the transfer. So, I mean, the analogy, because it's written to Israel, but at the same time, these scriptures are for us. Now, I say that to say this, is that the hour is very, very late. The information that I'm getting from, that I've received for quite some time, that as of the mid-70s, the whole Nazi goal to create a Superman through the technology and the occult information being shared on eugenics, that they have first-generation hybrids now as of 1963. As of the mid-70s, what we used to talk about those that are the oligarchy of plutocrats that represent, like the Bilderberg Group, and those are the heads of what we refer to as the Illuminati. That's no longer human. The reports that I'm getting, Doug, is that these are now... It's now transferred. This has been taken over by hybrid. This is the information I'm getting. Now, history is in God's control, but at some point, they're going to orchestrate disclosure, and they have the whole thing set up for the deception that these are, these are our saviors, and they've come to deliver us from self-destruction, move us on to our next evolutionary phase, to Homo Noeticus or Ubermensch or however. So we're right on the cusp of this. So somehow, as the people who are listening to this, we have to recognize that it's very, very late. It's very late. And for us as the body of Christ, we need to really understand what the Spirit is saying to the churches. You know, Revelation 2 and 3, Jesus said, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit is saying to the churches. So at some point, I'm going to ask you as to if you had an opportunity to go into the pulpits of America and say, okay, if this was the only opportunity you had to share what God has done in your life and what He has shown you, what would you say to the church, Doug? I would like to have you address that at some point. But in terms of any other comments or thoughts on, do you see any parallels to where we as a nation are at this juncture in history and where Nazi Germany was in pre-World War II?
Well, there's certainly, I think there are some. I think that there's certainly a general mindset that, that Americans are not as mystical, generally speaking, as, let's say, the German mentality was in the 19th century. The German mentality was well cultivated to take the seed and the watering of a kind of an occult kind of approach to solving the problems of Germany. It was combined, however, though, with the misery of the defeat, the Treaty of Versailles that had enormous reprisals, limited severely what Germany could do. Germany, of course, was experiencing poverty, chaos, riots in the streets, and so forth. You know, one might sooner see what's going on in England right now is sort of that. But many others would say, you know, we are only a few events away from riots in the street in America. And I can believe that's true. There's a number of financial analysts that write that are Americans that talk about where to put your money and so forth, and they are saying the same things, that America as we have known it is soon to come to an end. There will be riots in the streets. There will be chaos. And so consequently, and these are people, of course, that are speaking not from a spiritual base, just from the standpoint of protecting your investments, protecting your assets, that are saying, you need to wake up, America. The world is changed. America is no longer in the position that it once was, and it is soon to experience, you know, martial law, chaos, long lines, not just at the filling stations, but at the grocery store. There are, you know, we are perhaps months, a few years, not even decades away from these kind of events. And so, you know, you never want to be accused of being an alarmist, but there is a point in time where you're no longer an alarmist, you're a realist. And we know, even scientists that are secular, that are atheistic, many of them are saying that this is the last century for humankind. At the best, the humankind must suffer billions and billions of deaths in order to give the earth a chance to recover. We've overpopulated the world. We've polluted it, and so forth and so on. And so there are many scientists that have spoken up and said that. But from a Christian perspective, from the standpoint of where we are politically, It is very difficult to be optimistic that any kind of political change can occur. We are so gridlocked with the Republican and the Democratic parties and the political system that, while, you know, I love the American system, it was based upon certain principles. One, that the people were moral. Two, that the people were well-read and intelligent. And three, that the representatives would do the right things, that they would put ahead, you know, their own sort of political ambitions. They would put ahead the need for what the people required versus their own personal needs. None of those things are true today. And so we see a system that is, you know, in America, of course, where it's, you know, the special interest groups that are really in control, ineffective governing bodies, and basically a government that is at least twice too big what it needs to be and what we can afford. And so, you know, not to get too far into the political side of things, but the point, I guess, is that there's really not a reason to be hopeful. The only thing that can radically change our government is for some kind of radical event, like a 911 event, to happen, but probably on a much wider scale. That is the only thing that I think can conceivably jar loose the gridlock in Washington and cause the government to reevaluate what truly is important. And so consequently, I'm at the point where if I had the pulpit, I would basically say, you know, we're staring down, you know, sort of a gun. And we may have months, we may have a few years, but we don't have decades. And there are great changes that are going to happen. And the issue is whether we're prepared spiritually first. I'm not talking about becoming a survivalist, and, you know, I have my own questions about how much preparation is appropriate. You know, from that standpoint, being that I believe in a pre-tribulation rapture, but, you know, the requirement is that we trust in the Lord and we trust in His ability to provide for us. And you know, the third book I've written, which we haven't talked much about, but Black Sun, Blood Moon, that's essentially the premise of the book. That's really what I talk about, is that the Christian religion is apocalyptic religion. Every generation, I think, Doug, when you and I were talking yesterday, you made this point to me that, you know, every generation in the New Testament, really, in the Christian church, should see itself as the last generation. That's really the way that the Lord taught us to think, that the coming of the kingdom of God is imminent. It is always imminent. And that our religion and what catalyzes the Christian faith is that recognition that the apocalypse is always close at hand. And I think in our day there are so many unique factors. There, you know, the resurrection of the land of Israel, and we could name many others, but so many factors that say that time isn't just running out, time is all but run out. And we are in the last days, in the last days of the last days.
Yeah.
And so I think that the issue of getting our hearts right with God, of asking ourselves what is it that we should be doing at this moment in time, to do everything we can to pray and to speak with those we love, those that we come in contact with, to extend an offer to help people understand how they can accept Jesus Christ into their lives, into their hearts, and have His grace transform their lives. We are at that point where, you know, it's no longer business as usual. And it's that time. So I'll get off my soapbox. But anyway, you asked, I decided to share.
Yes, no, I appreciate that. I think, you know, what I want to just bring in, and this will just take a little bit here. This is in the chapter and Pandemonium's Engine.
Yes.
There's a couple of the authors, they kind of think that they indicate that they can bypass the Genesis 6 event where there was actual sexual involvement. I take issue with that, but the book is very much a groundbreaking book. It's a real eye-opener. And in this chapter 10, it's called The Storm, excuse me, To Storm Heaven, To Be Like God, To Rule the World, by Carl Takerib, if I pronounce his name right. And, you know, you mentioned that where we are today, we're not exactly necessarily, there's an equation where the spirituality is in place as it was Nazi Germany. But as I read through this particular chapter, I think that spirituality is there, but it's been rewritten. Like instead of the eugenics, it's called transhumanism. Mm-hmm. In other words, what we call science and all the ethics and the biotechnologies and the artificial intelligence, it's spiritually driven. And here's what he says. I'm going to, he talks about in his chapter, Lucifer, offers a philosophy of hoary antiquity based on the researches of the sages and seers. He's quoting from one of these New Agers. I think this is this man is one of the writers of the Theosophical Society. I can't remember that.
Okay.
Henry Clausen. But he basically compares, you know, Christianity is outmoded. And that Lucifer is the way we should go because he's the god of enlightenment. So, I mean, there these lines between what we would normally refer to as humanism or secular humanism, the man becoming God is the Luciferian doctrine. I mean, it is spiritually. He says, in theosophy, this Luciferian-inspired evolution occurs through the seven root races and ascended masters, individuals, who have already transfigured to a higher plane, assisting mankind's perfection. So it's the goal of the transhumanist to assist in mankind's perfection. What is it? One of the transhumanists, I forgot his name, Wurzel.
Okay. Well, there's Watson, but I don't think you're thinking
of
that.
I've forgotten his name because there's a whole movie done on him. But he asked him the question. He said, "Do you believe in God?" And he said, "Not yet." In other words, when we reach singularity, why then you can ask me then. But he goes on to say, he says, "Theosophy."
Oh, Ray Kurzweil. Ray Kurzweil.
That's it. Ray Kurzweil.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, Ray Kurzweil.
That's it. He says, "Theosophists tell us that we are moving into the sixth level of existence, with the final act soon to take center ring." Robert Elwood explains, quote, "This is how I see the coming sixth root race, an amalgamation of all those relatively enlightened individual humans into what is really a transhuman stage, the neuro-technological linkage of all minds into a grand array of consciousness." Well, that's totally a cult. Then he goes on to say, "That united supermind will be the seventh root race, the last which will have need at all for this physical world, and which we hope will live on a spiritual level appropriate to its tremendous leap into cosmic consciousness." Well, there's Adam, there's Blavatsky, there's the whole New Age thing. And of course, we know Alice Bailey wrote, what, 20-some books. She's like the theologian of the New Age under that demonic thing. Now, I'm just going to read on here because I want to just kind of move this into our closing time, because I know that we've been on here about an hour and 10 minutes. But if we're okay, Georgiana, are we okay?
Yes.
Okay. In this section, page 373, continuing on with the author, and I'm sorry I don't have his name, it's Carl Takerib. He says, faith in Lucifer, faith in man. And then quoting, the modern transhuman movement has largely been secular, atheistic in its outlook, rather than the biblically-oriented holy God who created mankind, extending mercy and judgment, concepts laughed at by many transhuman advocates. Science becomes the light to guide humanity. Ironically, while the future is being explored within the hardwired environment of laboratories and technical institutions, the foundation of transhumanism rests on an ancient religious desire, apotheosis, man becoming as God. Therefore, transhumanism is the technical quest, get that, technical, scientific quest for the Holy Grail, ascension through engineering. It is the techno-alchemy, or future magic, as suggested by past director of the World Transhumanist Association, Giulio Prisco, who optimistically dreams of unlimited potential. So I'm going to continue on. Quoting, space-time engineering and future magic will permit achieving by scientific means most of the promises of religions and many amazing things that no human religion ever dreamed. Eventually, we will be able to resurrect the dead by copying them into the future, unquote. I'm quoting for this man. Then the author goes on, religious themes abound in transhumanism landscape. Well, occult and spiritual themes abounded in the Fourth Reich. So here we are. It has a new veneer.
But it has an American character that's a little different than the German character of the, you know, of 1920. But you're absolutely right. If you look at the whole issue of the New Age movement, and this is what I talk about and what I'm really describing, the essence of 2012 and the other talk I gave about the dark history of 2012, that's really the point, is yes, there's an American sort of veneer, but underneath it all, it is absolutely as you're describing it. Let me go ahead and let you finish.
Well, yeah, this is, and there'll be quite a bit for you to comment on when I'm through with this. So the author goes on, he says, religious themes abound in transhuman landscape, mirroring aspects of Comte, while indulging in the transhuman perfection spoken of in esoteric camps. Moreover, for all its secular humanism, there is considerable discussion about the biblical God, who supposedly isn't real. Here, anger and hostility is directed at him, while desiring to elevate humanity to a position that supposedly doesn't exist, God. Some, like Max Moore, explain this as being symbolic and not ontological. Yet the weight of the loathing often makes it difficult to see this as merely emblematic. Here's what I'm getting towards here. Mm-hmm. An example can be found in the earlier work of Mr. Moore, the founder of extropy. That is, instead of everything dying down, we're going to continue to evolve and reach some utopian state. So the founder of Extropy Institute, quote, the original transhumanist organization founded in 1991. He is an atheist, at least concerning the Christian God, a position he stated at the 2010 Transhumanism and Spirituality Conference in Salt Lake City, Utah. Transhumanism and spirituality. That's interesting. Like many atheists who seek a post-human reality, his animosity toward the God of the Bible was palpable, referring to him, God, as a petulant child, quote, a cosmic sadist who seems to like to set things up to torture us, unquote. This reinforced what he wrote during Extropy's first official year, advocating the cause of his institute, he published an article, Atheist Notes, titled In Praise of the Devil. And I'm going to quote this whole thing, and then I'm going to, I'd just like to hear your comment. Quote.
Sure.
Mr. Moore, my goal is to bring out the values and perspectives of the Christian tradition and to demonstrate how it's fundamentally at odds with the values held by myself and all extropians. That would include the transhumanism and the final phase of evolution, both spiritual, physiological, scientific, towards the singularity. Or as the one, was it Teilhard de Chardin, however you pronounce his name, he referred to it as the Omega Point. The story is, quoting him again, Moore, the story is that God threw Lucifer out of heaven because Lucifer had started to question God and was spreading dissension among the angels. We must remember that this story is told from the point of view of the goddess, if I may coin the term, and not from that of the Luciferians. I will use this term to distinguish us from the official Satanists with whom I have fundamental difference. So he says he's a Luciferian. And everyone that I'm working with that comes out of the European royalty, they're all Luciferian. They don't see themselves as Satanists. Okay,
yes.
Now he goes
yes.
on to say, the truth may just as easily be that Lucifer resigned from heaven. God, being the well-documented Satanist that he is, no doubt wanted to keep Lucifer around so that he could punish him and try to get him back under his, God's, power. Probably what really happened was that Lucifer came to hate God's kingdom, his sadism, his demand for slavish conformity and obedience, his psychotic rage, and any display of independent thinking and behavior. Now, the reason why I'm reading this is so outlandish, but this is not atypical. This is the emerging scientific religious community that we would normally say these are secular humanists, but they're not. He goes on to say, Lucifer realized that he would never fully think for himself and could certainly not act on his independent thinking so long as he was under God's control. So there, the Antichrist, who is he? The spirit of lawlessness, anomia. And this is what we see, lawlessness here. So continue on. Therefore, he, Lucifer, left heaven, that terrible spiritual state ruled by the cosmic sadist Jehovah, and was accompanied by some of the angels who had had enough courage to question God's authority and his value perspective. Lucifer is the embodiment of reason, of intelligence, of critical thought. He stands against the dogma of God and all other dogmas. He stands for the exploration of new ideas and new perspectives in the pursuit of truth. I have to say this. He says this, praise Lucifer, with exclamation. It's horrific.
No,
praise the pursuit of, in other words, he goes on, praise the pursuit of truth through rationality. God was right to tell us not to worship false idols, but he refrained from telling us that all idols are false and that all worship is dangerous. Even our praise of Lucifer must not be worship of an idol, but rather an expression of our agreement with his value orientation and his perspective. What is that? Man, you shall be as God, and you shall not die. And here's what is true. No one has authority.
Yeah, amen.
He goes on to say, no one has authority over you. You are your own authority. You are your own value chooser, your own thinker. Join me. Join Lucifer and join extropy in fighting God and his entropic forces with our minds, our wills, our courage, and of course all of our technologies that are leading to singularity or transhumanism. Continuing on, God's army is strong, but they are backed by ignorance, fear, and cowardice. Reality is fundamentally on our side. Forward into the light, unquote. I know that's a long one. But, I mean, this embodies what we're up against. And Doug, I would say 99% of the pulpits are completely asleep to the fact that this ideology is completely permeating all the technological advances that are moving us forward to what this book, Pandemonium's Engine, is all about. So you comment any way you keep it.
Well, you plowed up a lot of ground, brother. So let me tackle some of these issues that you plowed up because they are fascinating. I think first off, the whole issue of the Luciferian doctrine right out of Freemasonry, of course.
Yes.
You know, this is exactly what Albert Pike wrote about. It's what Manly P. Hall wrote about. You know, Lucifer is the enlightened one, and you know, it's even the Bible, of course, you know, makes it very clear. Yes, Lucifer likes to parade around as an angel of light. So that doesn't make him the luminous one, but that is the way he likes to parade himself around. The second thought is just how closely that mirrors the diatribe that one could read from Nietzsche. It
yes.
is so close, the same issue of we must overcome the values, we must be our own selves, we must not let God keep us from living life to the fullest, and so forth and so on. And so you could say, gosh, this guy is, you know, is Nietzsche with an American accent.
Yes.
And so that's of course an amazing part of it. Another thought I have is, you know, I unfortunately had the challenges of growing up in the very liberal churches, but you know, even liberal Christian churches that don't take the Word of God as the inerrant Word of God, as the inspired Word of God, even those Christians should stand resolute against such absolute horrific statements as what you've just shared.
It's hubris.
I mean, even they, yeah, the hubris, even they should have, you know, reason to be alarmed and to be preaching adamantly against such a Luciferian notion that is so blatant. So that's another thought. And then, you know, I guess coming back to the original question, which is, you know, what are the parallels that we see in sort of the mentality in America? You know, I guess I was, you know, probably wrong to say that, you know, that America doesn't have the same mindset. I'm being a little too academic, you know, and saying it that way. There is very much the same mindset. The New Age movement, the 2012 movement, it's absolutely in the same guise. In fact, I might quote a scholar here. this is what I wrote in the paper, The Dark History of 2012. The unique aspect of this worldview, this Weltanschauung, as the Germans call it, is how it modifies the traditional pantheistic monism of Eastern religions with an emphasis on individual experience, specifically the encounter with the supernatural. As indicated from the citations above, it also seeks to express its views with scientific language to appeal to the Western mindset. So in other words, in part I'm saying that the way we Americans handle it is we emphasize American individuality, we emphasize science, but it's still very much, very similar to sort of the German worldview, or what they call the Weltanschauung. Now, I go on, while Buddhism teaches that the Buddha state is achieved by recognizing all that is one, and that even our self-consciousness is an illusion, New Age thinking combines the meditative aspects of the Orient with the individualism of the West, encouraging super-spiritual experience which achieves personal power in the supernatural realm. New Age thinking, also known as the cosmology of 2012, is therefore beyond pantheism, despite the self-aggrandizement by offering a sophisticated worldview. Marrying scientific thinking with super-sensible awareness is, at its very core, this is the 2012 creed, and it's nothing more than occult and animistic paganism. In other words, we dress it up. We make it sound good in America. And yet there are, and there certainly are going to be those that are very strong advocates, as you just read, about the transhumanist who's really a Luciferian. There will be others that would abhor that, and yet they would strongly assert that the need for us is for a consciousness raising. And in fact, that's really, to quote a few folks from the 2012, sort of the 2012 sages, this is what they believe. Many of them don't believe the world is going to come to an end in 2012. They believe this is when the new age arrives. This is when the transformation happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I find this quote particularly interesting because it goes beyond just the mere notion that humankind can improve itself based upon science. Here's what Tammy Simon wrote. She wrote, 2012 is most often described as a choice point, a time of intensified possibility and opportunity, rather than an apocalyptic time bomb destined to explode at midnight on December 21st, 2012. Opening to the possibilities of 2012 requires us to open to mystery, to open to the powers of the cosmos that are transhuman. So she's really talking about opening ourselves to entities in the cosmos that are other than human. And so you will see a strand of folks in 2012 that are advocating that we consider being channelers, that we open ourselves to spiritual entities and so forth. So you're not going to see, it's not like it's a single solitary sort of ideology. It's a combination or amalgamation of a number of ideologies. But at its core, just as you're saying, Douglas, it is absolutely paganism. And it is the American version of the Third Reich and what it was promoting. There's an expanded version of my chapter on the Ubermensch and the Antichrist and Decoding Doomsday, where I go down a bit different path and I talk about Nietzsche's concept in his book, The Genealogy of Morals, and where he talks about the comparison between the two facades, the Apollonian or Apollo facade versus sort of the Bacchus facade. Bacchus, much more of the, you know, is sort of the if we talk about Freud and the ego, the superego and the id, you know, Bacchus would be the id, the sort of the sexual impulses, sort of the craziness and so forth, whereas Apollo is much more sophisticated, much more in sort of keeping with our sort of Western Cartesian manner of thinking.
Yeah.
And at the end, what I say is that the Antichrist, you know, at the outbreak at the beginning of the 20th century was very much more like the god Bacchus in terms of the German mentality. But the Antichrist that I perceive is coming to life in America is much more Apollonian. And, of course, it happens to sort of fit into Tom Horn's notions of Apollo, in effect, as sort of the ancient god that is embodied in the Antichrist that is, as you know, in Revelation 9, the king of the bottomless pit is Apollyon or Apollo or Abaddon in Hebrew. And so we know there is this connection between Apollo and the Antichrist. And my sense is that, as I say in Decoding Doomsday, is that the Antichrist will be a more sophisticated, Americanized-like version versus a Hitler version. Americans won't take quite to the same style that an Adolf Hitler had, but we're very open to a spiritual approach that is more sophisticated, more individualistic, that really kind of appeals to our desire to be individuals that are self-actualized and so forth. And of course, what could be more self-actualized than being promised that you can become a demigod or an Ubermensch? And so, at the end of the day, the answer, yes, there are lots of parallels ideologically as well as some parallels politically to where, you know, we find America, you know, at this present moment.
Yes. I think, you know, as far as our discussion tonight, I wanted to go into the Decoding of Doomsday, but I need to read it first. And so,
sure. I need to send you a copy. I need to send you a copy, express mail. And I will do that. Are you still there?
Douglas?
Yes. I think we may have lost Douglas Riggs.
Oh my goodness. Well,
Ben Woodward.
Oh goodness.
Well, perhaps we should wait probably George Ann for just another minute or two and see if you know, if he'll dial back in to us somewhere, but I'm not sure, given our technology, if we can do that or not.
I don't think so.
I don't know that we can. Well, perhaps you and I should conclude the program. What would you like to say, I guess, as we're trying to wrap this up?
Well, I think it's been very, very interesting. And I would like to have you back sometime.
Good. I'd love to. Appreciate the invitation.
Good, good. Everybody, you've been listening to Douglas Riggs and Doug Woodward. And give the names of your books.
Sure. The two books that are most recent, Decoding Doomsday, is a more lengthy book, a little bit more scholarly book that really looks at all the factors out there today in terms of doomsday, the different theories about doomsday. I cover, talk about Sir Isaac Newton, I talk about Nostradamus, and ultimately what I do is talk about the ultimate book of prophecy, which is the Bible, and why anyone that's intrigued by 2012 and prophetic matters should ultimately dig into the Bible, because there's so much more information, so much more detail, and so many more insights as to what's going to happen, and of course, importantly, spiritually, what we must do to be prepared. And so Decoding Doomsday, again, the listeners can just type in Decoding Doomsday at any one of the search engines, and you'll find a number of bookstores there selling that. The more recent book is called Black Sun, Blood Moon, and it's really addressed specifically to Christians. It's more along the lines of, okay, time is growing short. What do we need to be doing? What do we need to be thinking about? What should we be considering that can encourage us? I'm about to lose my voice, Georgianne.
Yeah.
So that book is called Black Sun, Blood Moon, and that also is available from a lot of different bookstores.
Okay. Everybody,
go ahead. I might comment one other thing. Was the book that Doug and I were talking a lot about was Pandemonium's Engine.
Yes.
And that book is also by Defender Books, and it, too, can be found at many different bookstores. And I would encourage everyone to get a copy and to read that, because it is, even though there are many aspects of it that need to be supplemented with some of the some of the experiences that Doug Riggs has talked about,
mm-hmm.
It nevertheless is very much a groundbreaking book and one that needs to be shared with Christians far and wide.
Okay, well that sounds very good, and everybody
Great.
Get copies of Doug Woodward's books. He's put a lot of work, a lot of time, and a lot of study into these books. And he's not a novice. So Don't hang up.
I won't. I'll stay on.
Okay. This is Georgianne Hughes with Douglas Riggs and Doug Woodward signing off tonight. God bless everyone that's listening. Good night.